Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As this long presidential campaign comes to an end today, one issue of foreign policy that has been present throughout the campaign has been the U.S.-Chinese trading relationship. Now, most Americans probably think our trading relationship is a modern invention, truly beginning with the opening of China in the 1970s and the subsequent rule of Deng Xiaoping. But in fact, the first official American trading with China began when the ink on the treaty ending the American Revolution was barely dry. My guest today tells the story of that early relationship. Eric J. Dolan has written about the history of whaling in his best-selling book, Leviathan, and how fur traders began the westward expansion. His latest book documents the U.S.-Chinese trading relationship in the first 100 years of our country when America first met China, an exotic history of tea, drugs, and money in the age of sail. It's published by LiveRight. And he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Eric J. Dolan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Obviously, U.S.-Chinese relations have been an issue in this election, and it's some small irony that it's been mainly about trade because the oldest relationship between our two countries goes back to trade, and that's exactly what you've written about. I was amazed to know how far back trade with China went. For some reason, I thought that when Commodore Perry opened Japan in the 1850s, that was probably when we first made contact with the Chinese. But this is one of our earliest trading relationships. Why was trade with China so important early in our U.S. history?
Well, you have to go back a little bit in time because before the American Revolution, the Americans had almost a love affair with things Chinese. They were very aware of what was coming from China because the British East India Company had been bringing exotic Chinese goods to American shores since the mid-1600s. On the eve of the Revolution, Americans had been consuming more than 1 billion cups of tea, perhaps the primary Chinese product to come to American shores. So right after the American Revolution, the Americans were seeking ways to enhance their own economy now that they were their own country. The British East India Company's monopoly was vanquished because we had beaten the British. And one of the sterling opportunities that merchants foresaw was heading all the way to China on their own, something they had been foreclosed from doing on account of the British East India Company's monopoly. And right after the American Revolution was over, some merchants who had deep pockets and one of the richest of all, Robert Morris, a signer of the Declaration of Independence and the man who had earned the moniker financier of the Revolution, got together with some other like-minded merchants, and they funded a voyage that left in February of 1784, the Empress of China, to head all the way to Canton and bring back the tea and silk and china or porcelain that Americans had grown accustomed to having.
That was quite an undertaking. I mean, why China as opposed to other European countries? Was the British influence keeping those European countries from trading with us, or what exactly?
Well, there were a couple of things going on. One is right after the war, the British sort of locked out the Americans from the West Indian trade, which had been a major source of income in the American colonies. So the Americans were eagerly looking for different financial opportunities abroad. They weren't completely shut out of the European trade. And in fact, a couple of years after the Revolution, there was a very active trade already reemerging between Britain and the United States, as well as with other European countries. So America was spreading its commercial tendrils, not just to China, but to anywhere that it could get a good deal. But China was one of the first countries that it reached out to after the war.
Now, the Empress of China went over with a full load. What did they go over to trade with the Chinese? It was very interesting. Ginseng was a big product.
Right. They had on board everything from lead to alcohol, to furs, but also 30 tons of ginseng and $20,000 in Spanish silver dollars. And as you mentioned, ginseng was something that the Chinese were very interested in. In fact, ginseng, a certain species of ginseng, had been growing in China forever and had been used for thousands of years by the Chinese as an aphrodisiac and a curative for a great array of maladies. The Americans had their own species of ginseng, which grew along the eastern seaboard. They dug that up at a feverish pace, and they brought that to China, and that was also very welcomed by the Chinese. And they also really wanted Spanish silver coins, which at this time were the first truly global currency. The Chinese used silver to pay their military and government officials, and also the citizens there used it to pay their taxes. So the Americans that headed over in the Empress of China, they tried to put together a cargo that they thought would entice the Chinese merchants to trade, and it worked.
You know, it's funny, the very first instance of official trade between China and the United States, we're running a deficit from the very beginning because we send over silver coin to make up for the goods that were coming back from China.
Right. That was one of the amazing parallels in researching and writing about this history, and it was for a very simple but long-standing reason. The Chinese had been trading with the West for hundreds of years prior to the arrival of the Americans. And what other Western countries had discovered is the same thing that the Americans discovered, is that the Chinese weren't particularly interested in Western goods, but they were phenomenally interested in receiving silver in exchange for their own goods. So this did create a deficit, and for the first three decades of America's trade with China, up until the end of the War of 1812, roughly 65 to 70% of all the purchases that Americans made in Canton, China, which was the only port they could trade at, were made with silver. So we had a very large deficit from the beginning, and it extended throughout the entire period that I talk about in the book, which is up until the end of the 1860s.
Yeah, no, this is the other interesting thing, was that despite this long-lasting relationship, China was essentially closed yet open at the same time. Canton was the only place where trade occurred, and the regulations and the, I guess, the integration of traders with Chinese culture was almost non-existent.
Right. Well, the Chinese were very wary of Westerners. A lot of the early Westerners that had come over had not behaved too well, had been a little bit pushy. There have been instances of Chinese citizens being killed, and it was something that the emperor really wanted to keep Western influences out of the broader area of China. So he instituted in the mid-1700s this Canton system of trading, which restricted all Westerners to this 12-acre area in Canton, and it was a walled-off area. And they were subject to these eight regulations, which restricted their movements outside of the walled-off area. And also, one of the things that really annoyed a lot of the Americans is Western women were not allowed into this walled-off area of Canton, but a couple of Western women managed to sneak in nonetheless. And this system that greatly restricted how and where the Westerners, including the Americans, could trade, persisted until the end of the First Opium War in 1842, and at that point, four other ports in China were open. But even with that, it was a very limited perspective that the Americans and other foreigners got of China, and they didn't make great inroads into the rest of the country. They were kept at arm's length.
The Chinese were forbidden to teach their language to Westerners.
Right, they were forbidden under pain of death. But nonetheless, things have a way of happening whereby people find a way to communicate. They use this language that's called Pidgin English, which was an amalgam of English, Chinese, Portuguese, French, other words, and they managed to make themselves understood to each other. But also, some enterprising Americans, in particular some of the missionaries who went over, were able to learn various dialects, and some Chinese, very brave Chinese, in contravention of the law, managed to teach some of the Americans how to speak Chinese, and also some of the Chinese definitely picked up a facility over time in English.
Now, one of the interesting things your book does is it goes into really the history of all the products involved in early trade. For example, you tell us why ginseng was important in early trade. You also tell us how important tea was in our early history. Of course, we know about the Boston Tea Party. That was based on special levies created by the British basically to bail out the East India Company in the early 1770s. Why did tea catch on so early here, considering that we're a coffee culture today? In fact, I guess within a decade after of the war, we became more of a coffee culture. But why was tea so important early?
Well, bear in mind, of course, that the American colonists before the Revolution were part of England, and England had caught the tea-drinking bug very early on. The Dutch were the first Europeans to bring tea back from China. And quickly, that tea got smuggled into England. And then by the mid-1600s, the British themselves were going over and getting their own Chinese tea. And they just loved the taste of tea, of green and black tea coming from China. And it quickly became something that was consumed throughout the country. There were specially designed tea houses, as there also were coffee houses, where people could go to imbibe their favorite beverages. And that fashion jumped the pond, so to speak, went to the American colonists, and they became as dedicated tea drinkers as their English brethren across the pond. And as I said, we were drinking more than a billion cups of tea on the eve of the revolution. That's about 1.5 cups per person per day. And the supply had so greatly increased that the price went down. And so it could be enjoyed not only by the rich, but also by people of moderate means. And after the war, yes, tea drinking took a bit of a hit, in part because of the sour taste that was left in the mouth of many Americans on account of the Tea Party and other tea-related injustices that they felt had happened during the American Revolution. But Americans didn't give up on tea by any measure. Within a decade or two, they were importing 10 million pounds or more a year of tea into the country. But coffee definitely got a greater grip on Americans at that time. But even today, a lot of people I know love tea, and there are a lot of tea houses in America, as well as coffee establishments.
Now, what were the other products that we craved from China? Silk probably was a major product.
Yeah, silk, the big three, I mean, the big one was tea, far and away, for this entire period, not only for the Americans, but also for the British and most of the other countries that traded with China. Tea was the thing that was desired the most. Coming in second or third, depending on the time frame you're talking about, was silk, and then porcelain, which was a Chinese invention and was transformed into both beautiful objects of art and also very practical dishes and cups and saucers that could be used in America. But there were a whole lot of other items that came over at various times. The Chinese sent candy. They sent rhubarb. Rhubarb was thought to help with constipation. And the Chinese at one point thought that without Chinese rhubarb, that the Westerners would die because they'd become so stopped up. And there was also, they sent over plants, they sent over shoes. I mean, there were lots of other items that came over, lacquered furniture from China. And it was the same on the American side. We sent a lot of different things over to China, but far and away the number one thing that we used to buy products was silver, or they're called bills on London. They were a form of credit that the Americans used. But we also brought over other fascinating objects and things, such as sandalwood, which the Chinese really loved this wood because it had a fragrant oil within that could be used to make aromatic furniture and incense to burn in houses of worship. We bought hundreds of thousands of sea otter pelts to China and millions of seal skins. And one of the strangest objects we brought to China, which we used to trade with the natives of Fiji and the Marquesas and Hawaii and other South Pacific islands, was something called bêche de mer, which you probably know as sea cucumber. And the Chinese loved to flavor their soup with sea cucumber. It was supposedly aided in increasing your sexual prowess and also longevity of life. So there were a whole bunch of things going to China and things being returned to America.
My guest today is historian Eric J. Dolan, who has written on the history of whaling in his book Leviathan, Trapping as a Way of Creating Economy in Fur, Fortune, and Empire. His latest book is When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. What we haven't mentioned, that last part that's in the subtitle, that's drugs. And opium was not a major part in the U.S. trade, but certainly in Western trade to China. Opium was the big imported product to China.
Right, and opium was a solution to a problem that Westerners had faced, and that was particularly the British, who were the single largest trading partner with the Chinese. They, like other Western countries, had been forced to bring in enormous quantities of silver in order to purchase all the Chinese goods they desired. But this drain of silver was sort of becoming, it was hemorrhaging out of the country, and they desperately wanted to find some product or something else the Chinese would take in exchange that wasn't silver. And opium proved to be the perfect product because opium was prohibited in China. The emperor had prohibited its importation starting in the late 1700s, but the British brought it in nonetheless, where the Chinese were smoking it in increasing amounts. And what happened is the Chinese smugglers would pay for the opium with silver. So the more opium that the British and then the Americans later on brought in, the more silver that the smugglers would pay in return for this drug, which the Westerners could turn around and use to purchase the goods they desired. And this became a vicious circle, because by the late 1830s, the British alone were importing nearly 40,000 chests of opium into China each year. And each chest had about 130 to 150 pounds of opium. And as a result, vast quantities of silver were draining out of China and being used by the British to buy the goods they wanted. And also the Americans, who usually imported maybe 1,000, 1,500 chests of opium into China, were also making a significant income off of this immoral and illegal trade. And the Chinese emperor grew very concerned about this, not only because there was increased addiction, but because a lot of China's treasure in the form of silver was leaving the country.
Was it happening in Canton or prior to coming to Canton?
It was happening in Canton and later on all up and down the coast. What happened is there are a couple of things that sort of combined to make smuggling such a profitable operation, one of which is that a lot of the officials, the government officials who were charged with halting the opium trade, shutting it down because it was illegal, they not only smoked opium themselves, but also they took bribes to look the other way. And then the smugglers were very effective and efficient. They had these specially designed boats called fast crabs, that was one of the names given to them, which could be propelled at phenomenal speeds with 20 or 30 rowers pushing it through the waves. And on board, they would take the drug to different places on the coastline, and then it would be distributed throughout a distribution network that spanned much of the country by the mid-1800s. So it was a very efficient, effective, and profitable system that arose, and it was very hard to stop, very hard for the Chinese to stop.
And in fact, several wars were fought over that in the 1800s, which you write that we need to remember as Westerners, even though we weren't direct participants in the Opium Wars per se, that was really British, some French troops for the most part. We as Westerners need to remember that because this is a major part of Chinese history.
Yeah,
and it's why they distrust Westerners in many cases.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons.
Here in America, I mean, when I was working on the book and I learned more about the Opium Wars, I was amazed because this is something that in all my years of education, and I wasn't trained as an historian, but I had a fairly good education, I had heard almost nothing about the Opium Wars, and I think a lot of Americans are in the same position. However, in China, the citizenry there knows about the Opium Wars in great depth. For them, it's not ancient history. It's an indication of sort of the beginning of what they call the century of humiliation, where Western countries came in and almost reduced China to a semi-colonial status, engaging in a number of wars, beating the Chinese, forcing upon them treaties that took away some of the rights that the government there had to control its own economy and the country as a whole. And the Opium Wars, the two of them, one in the 1840s, early 1840s, and then in the late 1850s, are certainly seen by Chinese, even until today, as a very early sign of Western aggression. And it's on their minds when they interpret Western actions to force them to do things. If they perceive anything to be at all imperialistic or dictatorial in nature, they can look back upon the history of the Opium Wars as one of the earliest examples where they were, in effect, belittled by Western countries and treated shabbily. So it's something that it's important for people who are doing business with China and who want to understand China and its place in the world today, it's important to understand what their history was like and their history of relations with the West and how that may frame how they view interactions today.
In fact, in the latter part of the 19th century, nearly every major European power and the United States had, if not exactly the same situation as the United Kingdom with Hong Kong, they had these enclaves up and down the coast, which was basically their free trading zone where they would have small American communities, German communities that basically were kind of like very small colonies.
Yes, absolutely. It was also happening at a time when the Chinese Empire was slowly crumbling and
yes.
finally came tumbling down in the early 1900s. So not only was China being assaulted from without, there was also a lot of internal dissension. There were rebellions. There were great droughts, famines. It was truly a disintegrating time for the Chinese Empire, and they were being attacked from all angles, both from within and without.
My guest today is Eric J. Dolan, a historian. His latest book is titled When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail, which documents the opening of U.S.-Chinese trade, which took place literally as the ink was dried on the Treaty of Paris at the end of the American Revolution. And it is, in many cases, a very sad history because we've talked about the fact that opium was a big part of this trade. Maybe 10% of U.S. exports at one point, certainly greater for other Western powers. But we also haven't talked about the other, the human trade that went on between America and China, and that is the importation of labor, often referred to as coolies, who helped build the Transcontinental Railroad. And this is a particularly sordid history as well.
Yes, if I have to make a quick distinction there, the Chinese that came over and worked on the Transcontinental Railroad and also in the gold field were referred to as coolies, but they're not the main group of quote-unquote coolies that I talk about in the book, only because they were not treated as slaves.
They de facto had slaves, yeah.
Treatment. The part of the coolie trade that I focus on most intently is what happened in the mid-1800s, transporting nearly a quarter of a million Chinese down to Latin America to work on the tobacco, cotton, and sugar plantations. And although on paper they were supposed to be almost indentured servants, where they would work for a certain number of years for a certain rate of pay and then be able to pay off their indentured servitude, in reality they were just slaves by another name. And 19 nations participated in this transportation to Latin America. The United States was one of them. Between 1852 and 1862, 62 American ships took tens of thousands of Chinese down to Latin America to work in these hellish conditions on these plantations. And the most horrific place to end up was the Chincha Islands off Peru, where the Chinese were forced to dig guano, or bird waste, to be used as fertilizer in Europe and the United States. And the death rates on these plantations was astronomical, ranging from 50 to almost 100% before their contracts were up. And precious few of these coolies ever returned to China. And it wasn't only once they got to Latin America that they were dying at a rapid clip, but the transport over on these ships in which they were kept below decks and given very poor rations, and there were many, many mutinies. The death rate due to disease, mutinies, and suicides even approached 12% on these transport ships, and that's why they were called floating coffins. But another interesting connection with the United States is this is at the same time that the abolitionist movement and other like-minded individuals in the United States are fighting hard against the spread of slavery. Well, the abolitionists referred to the coolie trade as that other form of slavery. And in 1862, the United States became the first Western country to officially ban the coolie trade to Latin America when President Abraham Lincoln, signed a bill to that effect. But it's a very horrific passage in our relationship with China, and it was literally a trade in human beings.
And what about the Chinese that came to America? Not necessarily as bad as what they had in Latin America, but yet the restrictions were great, and they were very second-class citizens.
Oh, they were treated horrifically. I mean, after
less than second-class citizens, not even citizens.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were initially brought over in large part. They initially came over, many of them, on the so-called credit ticket system, where they could actually pay off their servitude after a certain number of years, and they were brought over by Americans as well as Chinese syndicates. But once they got here, even though they provided a very valuable and much-needed form of labor, not only in the gold fields but on the Transcontinental Railroad, they were treated horrifically. They were viewed as aliens, not given full rights. They were taxed heavily, beaten, sometimes killed, lived in squalid conditions. It was not a... It's not a part of our history that reflects well on how we have treated immigrants to this country, and it ultimately led to the exclusion rules in the 1880s, where Chinese were forbidden from immigrating into the United States unless they were of a certain class. So it's definitely a sad passage in America's history, but not one that I spend a large amount of time talking about in the book, because it wasn't officially part of the China trade, but it was certainly a big part of the Chinese-American experience.
You know, just our last question, you know, when we think of current U.S.-Chinese relations, Americans tend to think of U.S.-Chinese affairs beginning in 1972 with Nixon's trip to China, when China was reopened. But Chinese do not see it that way. Is that an important distinction when we're talking about foreign relations between the two countries?
I think so, and if you believe that history informs the present, then the answer is absolutely yes. Whenever a government is interacting with another government and making decisions, those decisions aren't based only on recent events, but they're also often based on the long play of history. And with the Chinese, they not only can look back, but they also know a huge amount in the present about their history with the United States and other Western countries that goes back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The Americans, for their part, tend to view it the way I think you put it, that it was with Nixon's opening of China when our true trading relationship and broader relationship with China began. But I think, as this book shows, certainly in the early part of the Republic's existence in the United States, we had a thriving relationship with China that had many different elements that are important to understand if you want to completely, you know, understand our current relationship with China and what different factors might affect how we move forward into the future.
Eric Dolan, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Historian Eric J. Dolan speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa. You can see some of our past shows. Well, just a reminder, today is Election Day. Whether you're for them or against them, be sure and vote. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.